Welcome back to The Devil Within, A Season in Hell. Of all the media outlets that have covered the Son of Sam murders over the decades, and there have been tons of documentaries, news stories, jailhouse interviews with Berkowitz, podcast episodes, as well as entire series, Berkowitz had been portrayed on a number of dramatic TV episodes like Mindhunter on Netflix. Perhaps the most well-known is the feature film treatment the story received from none other than iconic New York filmmaker Spike Lee. In the summer of 1999, then, just 22 years after the murder spree, Spike released the thriller Summer of Sam, a brilliant, tense, sweaty, anxiety attack of a movie that captures a time and place, and most importantly, a feeling of what New Yorkers went through during that insane time in the city. Joining me in studio to discuss the film is longtime friend of the show, Jeff Marshall. Jeff is a film critic and host of the podcast On the Craft. Jeff recently appeared in episode 5 of A Season in Hell to share with us his thoughts on the incredible cinema of the late 70s and how art, at its best, is simply a mirror pointed at society. Mr. Marshall, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Excited.
All right. So you got a chance to screen Summer of Sam. Basically, we're doing this is going to just be like a rewatch episode.
Love it.
About this. And when I have movie questions, you're my go-to guy. So I remember seeing this movie in the theaters.
Likewise.
In 1999. And I'm from New Jersey. I grew up back east. Mm-hmm. I remember when Spike Lee came on the scene with Do the Right Thing. That was what, 88?
89.
Okay.
88 or 89, yeah.
So I was 15 or 16 years old.
Right.
Saw the movie in theaters. Loved it. And he's become a fixture. Okay. And there are a couple things that really stood out and surprised me about this. Because, I hadn't seen it in 25 years when I watched it.
Same,
okay. And knowing his movies before Summer of Sam and his movies after Summer of Sam, this sits alone in terms.
100%.
Okay. All right, good.
I would agree with that. All right. As far as his usual narrative,
His usual narrative is filmmaking techniques.
Yes, very much.
Camera movements, lighting.
Right.
A lot of stuff that we can talk about. But real quick, I just want to go over some of his work leading up to it. So like mentioned, Do the Right Thing. And this is not all of them. These are just my favorites. Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, Mo Better Blues, Jungle Fever. This movie was immediately preceded by Get on the Bus and He Got Game. And it was followed by 25th Hour and She Hate Me. Yeah. But he took about a 2-year break after 9/11. Okay, so he didn't have a lot of output. So first of all, talk to me about where you think Spike Lee sits in the pantheon of American directors or film directors throughout history, and his work leading up to Summer of Sam.
Well, to kind of piggyback on what you just said, the movies that he had prior to this that come out, whether it be Jungle Fever, Do the Right Thing, Mo Better Blues, obviously have fit a different narrative than this one had. I mean, he hadn't done, maybe Malcolm X, you could argue, but that was more of a biographical film that he did. This was not that. I think maybe a lot of people had expectations of this being about David Berkowitz, when in fact he is just the catalyst of what's going on in this story. So that I found interesting, because I remember going into seeing this movie. I was a senior in high school when this came out. Remembering back at that time as well, 1999, that was when the Blair Witch Project came out. That was like the first time that internet buzz was a thing about a movie.
Yeah.
I went in to go see the Blair Witch Project with 45 different versions of what that movie was supposed to be based upon what happened with the internet. This movie, speaking of Summer of Sam, was essentially supposed to be a true story. So again, you go into this with expectations of one thing or another, and you get a completely different story.
Yeah.
So I had not seen Mo Better Blues prior to this. I had seen Malcolm X. I had not seen Jungle Fever, and I had seen Do the Right Thing.
Okay.
So I had an idea of what kind of a story, you know, storyteller he was. Obviously a New Yorker through and through, you know, born in Brooklyn. I think having watched those other films prior to this one, it just surprised me. Yeah. I wasn't expecting what I saw. I remember even recently I just read Roger Ebert's review on that. You know, this is one of the few that didn't have any African-American leads. It really did not.
It had none except for himself.
Yeah, really.
And a very strange role.
Very strange role for him to take, and one that I don't actually think Spike Lee gets enough credit for what a good actor he is. Yeah. I don't think this one necessarily shows what a good actor he was.
But if in all of my research for the season, there was an African-American news reporter.
Yeah.
Very dry, very... I think he was trying to be that guy.
Okay.
Okay.
And I wouldn't have seen any of that footage.
Yeah, you should see some of that footage because it's weird.
Is he doing a spot on, not a parody, but is he doing a spot on impersonation?
That, he's doing an Uber version of that guy. Okay. Right.
All right.
He's doing a very exaggerated version of this African-American reporter that did a ton of excellent coverage of Sunset during the day, during the time. But it was a very strange performance from Spike Lee.
Well, it makes you wonder, too, because Spike would have been about 18, 19, 20 when this actually happened.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I believe he was born in 57.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
he was right in the age.
His interpretation of it at that time and then coming back to it.
Yeah.
20 plus years later.
Yeah.
I would be interested to know kind of what he initially had perceived, and then maybe if he went back and watched footage.
Yeah.
How that may have changed his interpretation of that person.
Well, you mentioned the cast, which is interesting.
Phenomenal cast.
So, yeah. Mostly white, Italian, Puerto Ricans, right? And then which was a departure for him.
Yeah.
Because he tells African-American stories and the guy's African-Americans in him, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Which he should. And I think he kind of announced himself kind of a lot like Tarantino. Tarantino casts to the story.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's it. It doesn't, you know, he has his favorites. He has his muses. Correct. He has his favorite actors.
Which Spike does too.
Spike does too. But he departed from that in this. He's worked with Denzel forever and all these people.
Right.
But then in the 25th hour, he did the same thing. Yeah. He just cast to the story.
Right.
Okay. Which I loved about it. Yeah. So this story, which again, and what makes a great movie, in my opinion, about like how Spielberg told the story of first alien contact through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm.
Spike Lee told the son of Sam story through the lens of a disintegrating marriage because of infidelity.
Yeah.
Okay. And how uncertain and fear-inducing and anxiety-ridden that is. And then you take those feelings writ large against a city of 8 million people and you can kind of understand it. Like he goes, if you have any idea of what it feels like to be in a struggling relationship that's crumbling and how bad you feel about it and how anxious you feel and how scared you feel, that's a little bit of an idea of how the city felt during the summer.
Very much.
Okay. So I found that really, really interesting.
Yeah. I would say that too, the dissection of that, of constantly wondering, is she going to find out over here on one end of the spectrum? The other end of the spectrum is tonight my night? Is tonight the night I get caught, one way or the other?
Exactly. And you see Leguizamo, we'll talk about the cast in a second, where he's like, he thinks that he's going to be the next victim.
The list, right?
He's next on the list for the son of Sam. Yeah. And that is just his guilt manifesting. Okay.
Right.
So it's really, really interesting. It's great script. I'm sorry. Let's talk the cast. So we've mentioned John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who at the time was the only actor I knew in this film.
Yeah.
Had Danny Ayala, he was supposed to be in it. Had Danny Ayala been in it, I would have known him based upon Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, Leguizamo, thanks to Romeo and Juliet, I hadn't seen Pest, but I mean, that was the only actor I knew.
Yeah.
And Leguizamo, yet you look at it now, like that's a powerhouse of actors.
One of our finest performers out there.
Why is he not in the conversation more?
I don't know.
You look at that.
Oh, he's incredible.
Yeah. And you look at his stand-up. And you look at the other body of... there is maybe two other people that could do what he's done.
I wouldn't even know who they are. I know, but I mean, look at his one-man shows. Look at his work on stage, his live work, his stand-up comedy work, his work.
Name it.
I know.
And then you see him in like Executive Decision and he can pull off action too.
Absolutely.
What is that?
He could be dramatic. Look at him in like something like John Wick. His presence, I mean, he's incredible.
He's a phenomenal actor. But he also has a look that you can't learn. You can't acquire his look.
Yep.
The way he speaks, I think it's just, he's one of the most unique character actors.
Gosh.
But
Sea of Love, the Pacino movie, right? Incredible.
So but good. Yeah.
And then we have Mira Sorvino, Oscar winner. Excuse me. Thank you very much.
2 years.
Mighty Aphrodite. Yeah.
Yeah. Woody Allen. Yeah. 2 years earlier. Something like that. Yeah.
Incredible.
Again, who just blew me away. I at the time, I don't think I appreciated it in 99.
I didn't either.
You know, I'd seen like, you know, Romy and Michelle, and I don't even think I'd seen Mighty Aphrodite as a 16-year-old.
Right.
But
yeah, whoa. It's one of those performances that's so natural, so you don't realize how good she is, you know?
Yeah.
Because we all have known, you know, people like that, that are going through that kind of pain, and they're very honest and open about it, you know? And that was, it was just such an honest, powerful performance. Yeah. So she definitely stood out. Like Uzama stood out. Adrian Brody, because there's also a coming of age story in this.
Amazing.
A very quirky, interesting way to frame a coming of age story.
It was ballsy.
It was really ballsy.
Yeah.
The way it was written was ballsy. The way it was directed was ballsy, because.
And if he had been that guy in that real time in that real place, it was ballsy to be that person.
Also ballsy, coming from the neighborhood he came with to make that decision to completely be himself and to go after what makes himself happy. Whoa, dude. Because listen, it takes all kinds, you know, and he really went after it. And which led to maybe my favorite performance in the movie, Michael Imperioli.
I did not know was a co-writer of the film. I had no idea.
Believe that that was him in that cowboy hat playing the owner of the gay club. He was so good. He had like three scenes, but he was so good.
I guess it helps when you write the script. Maybe you know what you're going for. I don't know.
I guess so. But he was incredible.
He was really good.
Anthony LaPaglia, completely underused. Yeah. Yep. Completely underused.
Maybe four scenes, the whole film.
He's so subtle and powerful and great.
Yeah.
And that was that storyline, how the mafia helped the police, was something that I found very, very interesting and that I explored in the podcast.
Don't you think it was interesting as well, Spike's choice to leave the police out of it as much? Like he did do a lot of like interview stuff, kind of like, I would say, just kind of move the plot along to give us updates as to where the police were as far as finding Berkowitz.
Yeah.
But really, they were a backdrop. And the mafia was put at the forefront, as well as Leguizamo's friends and their little private list that they had going on. I thought that was an interesting choice, again, to focus more on the people of the city and less about the cops. I don't know. Again, not living in that era, I can't really speak to the belief in the police at that time. But we know that high crime rate, a very, very dangerous time to be a New Yorker. I think that may have been almost kind of a tip of the cap to the police, to almost, Spike, I think in a way, maybe directly or indirectly, was protecting the police by not putting so much of it on them and putting the focus more on the people of the town.
That's an interesting point. I think to your earlier point, Spike was 20 years old at the time when all this was going on. And one of the main kind of storylines throughout these 13 months of the, you know, terrorizing that Berkowitz did to the city was how powerless the police were to do anything.
Absolutely.
Because of the random nature of the acts. Right. The police were just waiting for him to make a mistake.
Yeah.
Okay. So the police really weren't that front and center, other than everyone has overtime. We're blanketing the city with cops and hopefully we'll catch them. So I think that could just be a function of what Spike Lee remembers at the time. Mm-hmm. The cops really weren't that front and center because, you know, there wasn't much that they could do.
They weren't getting anywhere.
They weren't getting anywhere.
And I think the mafia, that was actually a great scene in the restaurant when the mafia is sitting there going, you know, what, how many people were killed in your city last night? How many people were killed? Go get one of them. It's like, we can get those guys. Yeah.
Racism front and center.
And we know how to deal with those let those go because they're racist. This is maybe white people being killed, so therefore we have to put more effort into it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
No, at the time. They made that very, very clear. Yeah. But I think one of the things that I guess just confused me about the script was that they set up that scene that you're talking about in the restaurant. They set up so much between Anthony LaPaglia and Ben Gazzara's character. Like, I treated you like a son, and you were my daughter, and now you become a cop. And then it went nowhere.
Very good point.
It went absolutely nowhere. They set that up. That could have been its own movie.
Absolutely. You know? I thought that was going to be some major subplot.
100%.
That was eventually going to intersect with the capture and or some sort of other sub scene later on in the film. But we never get closure on that. And it also makes you question, then what was the backstory necessary for in the first place? Why bring that up? Why establish that relationship to not follow through on it later?
So that's the cast. Who else in the cast? Jennifer Esposito.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Phenomenal. Again, I would say at least at that point, relatively unknown.
Yeah.
Had done some good things, but not, you know, not to the level where she ascended to eventually.
Let's talk about, for a second, performances.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I had some problems.
Oh, good, 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 good.
With a couple of them.
All right, good.
Like none of the main ones. Mira Sorvino, awesome.
Yeah.
Real standout performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mike Wazamo, terrific. Adrian Brody, as mentioned, absolute standout performance. Imperioli, great. In a supporting role. Jennifer Esposito was awesome in a supporting role. Mm-hmm. Rispoli was great as the mob boss. Well, not the mob boss, as like the underboss. Yeah. Gazzara was terrific. He does what he does.
Yeah.
Rispoli had a lot to do, and he was great. After that, I feel like the performances weren't really focused on that much. Mm. You know, like a lot of the mob henchmen, I thought...
Those guys were a waste of space bad. At times. Yeah,
just,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I didn't like those guys. Wait, John Savage had like fourth or fifth billing for like two lines as the photographer, right?
Yeah.
That was kind of weird, but good. But so all of the main characters, I really appreciated the performances, but a lot of the supporting cast, I really, really didn't like at all.
And I'm going to forget the character's name that was kind of the drug addict trying to sell the lobsters there. Smoker, drug addict, the heroin addict.
Yeah,
we see him shooting up later. I also felt like he was given a lot more attention.
Yeah,
than maybe he deserved. But I would say I think of the core guys that were on that street corner, he really did the best job.
Yeah.
And then of course the actor that we recently lost. It was on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That was
The
homosexual.
They call him Bob the Fairy or
something? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, just recently passed. But
I didn't even put that together.
Phenomenal job.
Whoa,
that he did.
That's right.
I'd only seen him really in Uncle Buck before Marvelous Mrs. Yeah. Maisel. It didn't really... He looked so different. I will just have to say
that. He was the
bartender
at the comedy club in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. He was Susie's, you know, right hand. But yeah, or Susie was his.
I knew I
recognized
that guy.
I would say that a lot of the supporting characters were... Although I will say Adrian Brody's father, played by, or stepdad, played by Mike Starr, especially at the end of the film, really does get to cut his teeth on some scenes.
Yeah, he does.
Him and Patty Dupont? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But anyways, both of those very small parts, I think, had a greater impact because you'd give me a scene that was rooted in love.
Mm-hmm.
So I had something between the two of them and Adrian to kind of build on and go through later. To the point where these other actors, I think that we're talking about, I don't necessarily crush them for their performances as much as, did we really develop them though? Did we have enough to give them context for what they were supposed to be doing? Did we give them enough as far as dialogue to really know where they're coming from? I don't really know. I feel like that, along with the story between LaPaglia and the mob boss, was just underdeveloped. Not enough there that they probably just could have just been scene fillers and not needed to really.
Yeah, I agree. But if they're going to be talking, if they're going to be performing,
right,
you know, like
I say, cut the dialogue at that point.
Yeah, like make it happen. You know, there are all these great stories about Scorsese. That great story from Jonah Hill with Scorsese, where he was on the scene where he's just quitting on the payphone.
Yeah,
you know, a couple of lines.
Yeah,
but he wasn't getting it, and Scorsese just cut, and he said, "Let's come over here and let's just talk for a while."
Mm-hmm.
And then they sat over in Video Village and didn't talk. Scorsese did a crossword and let Jonah just chill for a few minutes and said, "You want to go again?" He's like, "Okay." But Jonah knew, I'm not fucking getting it done, you know, and I better step it up. Yeah, right.
That's a good sign of a director. I mean, I was listening to a podcast on the way here with Mark Ruffalo on it, and he was fired from a job. And they said, "Yeah, we think you're making a different movie." He's like, "Well, whose fault is that?"
Mm.
"I'm not here making my movie. I'm here making your movie. So if I'm making a different movie than you want me to make, guide me, direct me."
Right.
That is the point. But I think to your point of sharing the Scorsese story, you have to know your actor, which one you're dealing with in particular, to know what do I say, or in this case, what do I not say, in order to get my point across, to get the performance I want.
Wow. All right. So we open up in this movie in 76, and having done all of the research that I did on all these murders, they were...
Yeah.
Pretty faithful recreations of the actual location, the modus operandi that Berkowitz would use, the people, the vehicles that they were in, the locations, like I said, all that was...
And as far as I know, the letters as well were almost verbatim.
The letters, there were some chunks that were cut out.
But okay, but for at least the what was shared, what was
said
was
actually
real.
Written from Berkowitz. Good. Yeah, which was really interesting. Starting with the Donna Loria murder in the Bronx, where it all kind of started. Mm-hmm. But they showed, you know, the Voskarichian murder where she was there by herself, put the school book in front of her face, all that. It was the two girls sitting on the stoop, mm-hmm. where he was trying to ask for directions but just stopped and then started shooting. in front of the nightclub in Queens. So they got all of them, which was really interesting to see that. Mm-hmm. And really incredibly violent and bloody.
Cold-blooded.
Gosh. So very well kind of executed there. I wasn't really into Badalucco's performance as Berkowitz. I felt that was kind of forced a little bit. What'd you think about him?
I did not care for the apartment stuff.
Yeah.
Anything outside the apartment I enjoyed, especially when he is arrested. The way he kind of looks around at the crowd, the way he looks in the car, I actually found him to be so compelling as an actor.
Yeah.
It reminded me very much of, it didn't remind me much of, but I guess you could draw a parallel to George Clooney at the end of Michael Clayton, just kind of riding around in the cab, not saying anything, but making a point.
It was a good movie.
And phenomenal. But like when I'm looking at Berkowitz and his reaction and taking it all in, that I thought was very telling of where he was mentally. And I thought the stuff that in his apartment, the stuff with the dog, all very forced.
Very forced.
To try and give us context why this guy is doing what he's doing.
Right.
And which I honestly kind of like the mob boss's, you know, henchmen, if you want to put it that way. Just not necessary. I didn't need it. Either. It didn't help the story. It didn't help me get him better. And because of the way the movie is, as far as we're not telling his story anyway, I didn't really need it in order to understand him. I don't need to understand Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight. I don't need to know that backstory in order for the stuff later on to pay off.
I agree.
You know, I can just chalk up to the fact that this guy was not of a sound state of mind and murdering people, because the story is about the rest of the cast anyway.
Yep. Oh, and B.B. Newworth. Awesome.
Who that? Again, I'm gonna give you credit for saying, you know, Spike always cast to tell a story. I would not have cast her.
Yeah.
But again, if I'm looking at Spike's point of view, this is a New Yorker who probably sees a lot of theater. BB is known for her theater.
Absolutely.
And probably saw that and said, I know where to put her.
Oh, and she was
terrific. And she was spot on.
And fearless and...
Yeah. Let's at least talk about the four or five main that we've talked about, BB, Mike Starr, Patty. I'm going to say there's about seven there of the main cast. You couldn't have casted anybody.
Yep, agreed. All right, so we start with, the film focuses on a marriage between John Leguizamo and Mira Sorvino.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Leguizamo is a very, very flawed character. Yeah. And I think they're somewhere in the Bronx up near City Island, which is a very remote part of the Bronx, like really separate from the city.
Okay.
There was actually a great movie called City Island with Andy Garcia that kind of focuses on that part of the city.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. But so they're really up and kind of out of the way, but also very New York, very Bronx, very outer boroughs. Exactly what you would think. Yankee fans, New Yorkers to the core, heavy Italian and, you know, very ethnically kind of mixed demographics up there. So it's John Leguizamo. Plays a Puerto Rican kid married to Mira Sorvino, an Italian girl. And they're both from the same neighborhood, right? They grew up together. They both kind of dated in the neighborhood before they got together, which, you know, I guess might be weird. I don't know. But if you grow up in a small town and stay there, it's bound to happen, right? You learn pretty much right away that Leguizamo struggles with fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be that kind of story. Okay. Which we, before we turned on the microphones, we were discussing a little bit.
Yeah.
And the kind of constraints that, or the expectation of a religious person kind of places on that.
And the constraints religion might place on a marriage.
On a marriage, exactly. And on someone like Leguizamo with a wandering eye, there are certain sexual needs that he has that he's been taught from a young age that you don't do with your wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That within the confines of Catholicism, within a marriage, sex is to make babies, period.
Correct.
That's it.
Yeah, procreation only. Yeah.
That's it.
Right.
Okay. So any other stuff that he feels like he has a desire for sexually, he would look outside the marriage. Mm-hmm. In a really strange way, out of respect for his
wife. For his wife, yeah.
Right. Which is such a fucked up way of thinking about it.
Right.
Right? Because then conversely, Catholic women are told to please your husband.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then the Catholic men are told, well, you can't do this kind of stuff with your wife. So it's a real kind of self-defeating kind of circular kind of reasoning.
Yeah.
And Leguizamo struggles with it.
Very much so.
Mightily.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Speaking about it before we started recording, it's painful in a way to watch that happen because it's so avoidable. Number one. Number two would be, and I think we talked about this before, is it's so masochistic, misogynistic. Sorry, I'm going to report that. It's so misogynistic in nature, and yet it's coming from a good place. Like that's the irony of it, is that I'm actually trying to protect my marriage by seeking these things that I want sexually outside of my marriage.
Right.
And yet you have a wife who, even painfully at times for Mira's character, Diona, will actually seek out opportunities to be everything. She knows what he's doing. She does. She hasn't come out and said, I know you're cheating.
Right.
But she knows, or at least has very strong feelings, right?
Yeah.
She's not dumb. And I feel like that's kind of the beauty of the story as it goes on. We kind of see Diona as a subservient, mild-mannered, I have to take care of my dad. His restaurant really needs me. No, honey, but I really want to be here for you, and I will. And nothing but love from her the entire time. And it's not until after they have an experience and they're parked in front of the cemetery where we actually see the Italian, I think.
Yeah, where she finds her strength.
Where she finds her strength and says, her limit. No, fuck you.
Exactly.
Now you're going to deal with what you've caused.
Yep.
Right? But the beauty of it, I think, is the beauty of her character, is that even with the knowledge of what her husband is doing outside the marriage, she still has a desire to be the wife that she feels that he deserves.
Yeah, she's committed to the marriage.
She is committed to the marriage despite, and she's, you can tell, she's blaming herself in a way for him needing to go outside of the marriage.
Yep.
And which is the most painful scene in the film. I know we talked about it. We touched upon it a little bit. Was her and Jennifer in the bathroom when we're all having dinner. And she is asking a former lover
of her husband. A girl from the neighborhood.
From the neighborhood. Yeah.
I know you've been with him before.
Not mad about that. I want you to teach me how to better have sex with my husband because I know you know what he likes.
Yep. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Happy January. Are you tired yet of all those New Year, New You offers clogging up your feed? I am. But hey, if that gets you motivated, then good for you. Go for it. But what if a whole new you isn't necessary? What if you're pretty stoked about some areas of your life? Maybe that relationship you've been working on is really thriving, or the job you committed to is finally working out. If you're looking to maximize what you're doing right, therapy might be the answer. A good therapist can help you define your strengths, get specific, and avoid the extreme resolutions that are difficult to maintain. BetterHelp is online therapy that adapts to your schedule. After they learn a little bit about you, you'll be matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists whenever you want for no additional charge. I've been telling my audience for 3 seasons now how I've benefited from therapy my entire adult life. So if you think therapy might be right for you, consider giving BetterHelp a try. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/DevilWithin today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/DevilWithin. And she tries to put on that blonde wig. She tries to do some extracurricular sex stuff with him.
Different name.
And the guilt gets on him.
Yes.
He goes, let's just do it normal.
Right.
Let's just do it normal.
Right.
like it's so strange that guilt of mistreating your wife is stronger than the guilt of cheating on your wife.
Yes.
It's such an interesting dynamic.
And what's crazy about it too, and I maybe this is just where my mind went.
Yeah.
So take this with a grain of salt. He lasted about 15 seconds with his wife.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
The other two scenes that we see with him with other women, no problem lasting. He does not love them.
Right.
He does not care.
Right.
He does not care. That's what I chalk it up to. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. You're welcome.
That's interesting.
You're welcome to give me feedback on that. But how he behaves during, before, during, and after the love scene with Mira, I thought was very telling.
Yeah.
You know, it started out to be this thing. She wanted to do this thing for him. He was on board with it. Right in the middle, said, nope, can't do it. Finish quick. Why? I firmly believe it's A, guilt, and B, this is my love. I'm not trying to be these things.
Right.
I don't have to be someone else. She doesn't have to be someone else.
Do you think this character loved her?
I do.
Yeah.
I really do believe that he loved her. Yeah, no, I actually bought their love very much.
Cool. Agreed.
I really bought their love.
So his character was a hairdresser.
Yeah.
Like one of these sexy tight pants hairdressers, right? That just had sex with all of his female clients.
Not the job I would have given him either if I was writing that script. I thought that was a really interesting choice. It makes complete sense.
It's total sense.
Who talks to more women than a hairdresser in the 1970s?
Total sense.
Yeah.
Yep. And he loved it, and
he did.
And he hated himself for it.
He absolutely
He was
did.
Such the yeah. picture of Catholic guilt.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be it's honest. I'm not so where I was.
No,
so
but it's become a. But. It's you know, like listening to Springsteen songs, he sings about his Catholic guilt, right? Listening to, I mean, it's in the vernacular, right? That Catholicism oftentimes equals guilt. It's strange. It's strange, but
it's got to be a very tormenting position to be in.
Yes, you would imagine. But it comes back to one of the basic doctrines of Christianity, that we're born in sin, but then we're commanded to be better. Okay? We're commanded to overcome the sin that our Creator so tenderly gifted us with in the first place from the moment we're born.
Mm-hmm.
You better not be this way. I created you. Right? So that is this crushing kind of yoke that Leguizamo's character is under the whole time. And he's got this beautiful weakness that he just surrenders to at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
At the scene with Bebe Neuwirth.
Yeah.
He's trying to get out of there.
Yeah.
But she's in her bra and panties. He's not going anywhere. He's trying over and over and over again to leave, but he can't.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
And in conjunction with that, I don't know, I always like directing choices, like little things like that. Did Leguizamo have to forget his keys when he got thrown out of the salon?
I would love to think that wasn't in the script.
I like to think that too.
Right?
But I want to connect it to your point. He could not leave.
Yeah.
That's what I think it is. It's like every time I want to leave, I
got
to go back.
There's
something pulling me back in.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Maybe it wasn't a directing choice at all. Maybe it was scripted. Maybe, I don't know. But I like to believe that if it was scripted and it was directed, it's so consistent with character.
Yeah.
So I do want to point it out because I think it was actually a really good choice.
Another thing that I didn't really think about until now, because he was wasted in that scene, that he's doing Quaaludes all the time just to escape from what he's feeling, right? And Quaaludes were everywhere back then.
Right.
They were the real ones.
Yeah.
And they fucked you up, right? And man, and Rispoli. So, and I guess Rispoli was a mid-level mob soldier,
something like that. Yeah,
right.
We don't really know.
Dealing drugs on the corner, right?
Yeah, yeah. But actually, again, God, that's another character actor I'd like to see more work of, because that guy can really nail comedy when he has to.
Well, listen, I know him.
And he's
from,
intimidating.
I know him from Rounders.
Yeah.
He was Grandma in Rounders.
Grandma,
he was great.
So
I know him as the bartender from Invincible.
Yes, he is.
Right.
And then he can do While You Were Sleeping, and he can be like the little quirky neighbor Italian.
And then
guy.
The Sopranos work.
Yeah, Sopranos.
You know,
small part in Kick-Ass, too.
But yeah. So
again,
he's
funny in that.
he's terrific. He's been around a long time. He's really, really terrific. All right, yes. So that's the main storyline, is that marriage. Then I think a more interesting storyline is the Adrian Brody character. And this was really Brody's kind of coming out party.
Well, and I read originally it was his film. He was the main character Leguizamo was supporting.
And so that's a couple times that happened to Brody. Because you remember, he was supposed to be the lead in The Thin Red Line.
Oh, I didn't know about
that. And he went down to almost barely in the movie.
Yeah.
But that's how, you know, Terrence Malick works. Yeah. It's a very, very, sometimes it's exactly what he shoots. Sometimes it's entirely different, right? And he basically gave the movie to Jim Caviezel.
I think that probably happens more often than you think. I mean, I'm sure as a writer, and you can speak to this, you see it on the page one way, you have it in your head one way when you get to set. And then an actor comes in and you say, well, shit, I didn't see that as a potential. I didn't know it was going there. And then Leguizamo, at least from what I read, with his ability to improv, really caught Spike Lee off guard and said, I got to give him more screen time.
See, that's interesting because, okay, I can understand the incredible and incredibly interesting and quirky and cool storyline that Brody's character had, why that would be an A story in a movie. Mm-hmm. I get it. Mm-hmm. But then the way that they treated the Leguizamo character, how his fear of being discovered as a cheater represented everybody in the city's fear of, am I next of the Son of Sam? That would make more sense in this story to be the A storyline. So it's interesting that Brody was originally supposed to, I mean, I get it. I could see it either way.
Well, I would look at it too. I have 2 points on that. Yeah. One would be, I think Berkowitz, you know, from listening to the pod and from what I know about the film and all that good stuff, Berkowitz had no arc, right? Beginning to end, he was this thing. Adrian Brody's character, Richie, I would argue, had no arc, really.
Yep.
The beginning of the film, he is who he wants to be, knows who he wants to be.
And we just see him working towards that.
Towards that. So I don't know that that's a compelling story. Which is why I'm glad Berkowitz wasn't the focus, and I'm glad Adrian wasn't the focus.
It's a compelling situational kind
Correct.
Of thing.
Correct. Right. Adrian, then Richie was able to become more of the heart, meaning the good part of it. He really was.
Yeah, 100%.
He was able to be more of a, you know, a more of a love character.
He was an innocent.
He was an innocent by far. And I think he represented, at least dialogue-wise, represented a lot of the people that were obviously wrongfully murdered by Berkowitz. But ends up being the face and the voice of all the other unfortunate, innocent people that the guys from the town decided to, you know, beat up, threatened.
Yeah.
And all that good stuff. But I would argue that, you know, Leguizamo, his struggles that you were pointing out, I think that arc, when we see his face looking at Richie at the end of the film, and he's lost his wife, now we've got our... Now we've got our closing scene. I think that there's a better arc there as far as story goes and character goes than Richie may have given us as the lead.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, when you break it down like that, it's so you have Richie, who ostensibly is doing stuff that he shouldn't be doing, according to the neighborhood he grew up in.
Right.
Okay. Quote, gay stuff
and the times,
queer stuff or whatever, porno stuff, you know. But he's honest about it. Mm-hmm. He's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
He treats his girlfriend honestly and treats her well.
Yep.
Doesn't force her into anything. Yep. She, another girl who's just out to please her man.
Yeah.
Right.
Very much. And finally finds one that's actually respectful.
Absolutely.
Values her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't want to use her.
Right. Exactly. Like she thinks all she's good for is sex.
Yeah.
And she tried, and he's like, you don't have to do that. What are you doing?
Absolutely.
You don't have to do that.
Beautiful scene.
Really, really nice and honest.
Beautiful scene.
And I'm like, oh yeah, cool. Good for him. He's a good dude.
Well, and actually it confused me at first there for a second because of his work as a performer in a gay club. I thought maybe he was homosexual.
Right.
I thought where we were going.
Oh, right. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't pick up on that. I didn't pick up on that.
Because he was like, oh, you don't have to do that. But he wasn't like, you know, disgusted by or anything like that.
No.
I almost got the impression
he wanted to
of
make
like,
sure he liked her.
Exactly. Yeah, which I didn't take
which
it as
Which is so
first.
Sweet.
Right. Right. I didn't take it that way at first.
So sweet.
Yeah. No, it was.
I'm not sure if I like you like that yet. Let's get to know each
other.
Which
no man had ever done to her.
She was like, what the fuck is going on?
I guess I have to leave. You just rejected me. He's right. Like, no, I don't want you to leave. Stay.
Yeah, it was so nice.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It was so nice. And then he's doing all of this stuff that the kids from the neighborhood where he grew up with, he had to hide it from them, right? He had to get into the city to be himself. CBGBs, right? The gay clubs, all of, regardless. Mm-hmm. And he was accepted in all of those places.
Yes.
He was accepted by Imperioli, a gay man, knowing that he's straight.
Yep.
Okay? Wasn't trying to do anything.
Right.
Like, Brody was begging him, I got to do one show. Let me do one show. Yeah. I want more from you. I got to do one show. Really weird, cool, like interesting shows.
Yeah.
Okay, right? Then, he does some illegal stuff. He takes, tricks up into his room, whatever, but he's trying to earn money. Okay, great. And then Leguizamo, who's got a legit job, right? He's married. He's, on the surface doing everything right. And is accepted by the guys in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a strange dichotomy going on, and it exists to this day. I grew up under a version of that, right, where there's a certain expectation of behavior from your friends that might not be the right thing to do. Like for me, because I was an action sports athlete, right? I was a skateboarder and a BMX rider. And I wasn't a baseball player or a football player or a wrestler like everybody else was in town, okay? Yeah. And so I wasn't exactly accepted right away.
And you were also a product of that kind of coming up at that time. That was also not, that was new.
That was brand new. Brand new, yeah. And so it was a little, like I stopped playing football and I wasn't good at football. I was a tiny, skinny kid and I'd get fucked up like every practice I'd get hurt, okay? And then I really liked this other stuff. And so there was some, it was a small town and my older brother is a really popular guy with a bunch of awesome friends. And so I had protection and everything. But then I found my own friends.
Right.
There were one or two kids in town that were into the same stuff. And then there were kids from neighboring towns. And so I built my own community and I wound up to go on to be super successful at it. And it was great.
Yeah.
It's
the old island of misfit toys. When you can find, especially I think we see that with, that was actually kind of beautiful with Esposito being the lead singer of that punk band.
It was a great kind of song.
Like, yeah, and I almost feel like she found something that she wasn't looking for.
Yes.
Which was identity.
She was a better singer than Brody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but again, I think the real big point you were making there is acceptance. When you have that island of misfit toys and you finally feel a part of a community.
Yeah.
Which, I felt at least my senior year when I finally decided to take theater and I was around other theater kids that liked performing. I mean, that was just, it's okay in this classroom to be a certain way.
Yeah.
That's so, especially when it's so outside the norm of what you grow up with and what everyone around you is telling you you should be. That's gotta be an amazing feeling.
And you're right. Seeing them on stage at CBGB's playing that song that they obviously wrote and that they're proud of was great. And she seemed, her character seemed free.
Yep.
And
they were accepted by
strangers. By straight, but that was their people.
Absolutely.
It was their people. And so you see when other members of their group, from their neighborhood, and it happened twice, Leguizamo and Mirasorvino didn't even make it inside the club.
Yeah.
They pulled up and then they fucking left.
Right.
Right. And then the Italians show up
and
they go in there and they're fucking disgusted.
Yep.
Okay. And then they leave. Okay. But then here's Brody and Esposito, from the same fucking block in the Bronx. And they are embraced by that community. Okay. Yeah. So.
And they want to be a part of that community.
They want to be a part of it. They want to immerse themselves in the community and they feel accepted there. And so what happens when Brody, in the third act of the film, leaves that community and comes, quote, home, he almost gets fucking killed.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the third kind of plot line from it, is the Italians trying to find the Son of Sam, trying to do it themselves, protect their neighborhood. They go to torches and fucking pitchforks, right?
Yeah.
I mean, create mob justice.
Yeah.
Mob justice, which never fucking goes well. Okay.
No.
They have their list, of people with no investigative acumen at all. Like, it's got to be this guy. They think it's a priest. They think it's this. They think it's that. Right? Reggie Jackson, because he's number 44. And so they land on Richie.
Yeah.
On one of their own.
Yeah.
Because he's different.
Yeah.
Right? Because he wears a dog collar. Because
They're just looking for any excuse. But really to get
him. But he's a kid that they're like, blood brothers almost. Like, they grew up together.
Like Leguizamo and him, but I didn't get that impression from the other characters. Did you?
Yes, I did. And this is something that Imperioli and Spike did really, really well with the script. Okay. People that aren't one of them, right? That one of us kind of a thing, right? Yeah. Can't talk to Rispoli in any kind of disrespectful way, or you'll get fucking smacked.
Yeah.
You'll get beat up on the street or whatever. Yeah. Okay. Richie could tell him, go fuck off, fuck you, get out of here, get out of here.
Yeah.
So could Richie. Richie could talk to him like that. And Rispoli's like, hey, come on, come on, right? There's so much leeway with disrespectful talk because it's like brother to brother.
Yeah.
Okay. So Richie was 100% one of them. Okay.
At one point, yeah.
At one point, exactly. And so how great the fear and anxiety must have been for them to turn on one of their own like that, right? Like, that only comes from a mob kind of mentality.
Yeah.
If you take Rispoli's character by himself, 100% you could talk him out of it. 100%. Take any one of his henchmen, any of those other three guys, even Bob the Fairy, take him by himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fucking Richie. But you get all of them together, egging each other on, go, we got to get this fucking guy. We got to get him. He's this. They even turned fucking Leguizamo.
Which I think, yeah.
Yeah.
I think turning Leguizamo, that's what he says. We need him.
We need you to lure him out.
Yeah,
right.
We need him to lure it out. You really don't. You could have gone into it. I mean, they went into the club to find him. They could have continued to find him. I think they really wanted Leguizamo's character to almost to validate what they wanted to do.
100%.
Because
to
your point, yeah, he was accepted at one point. They're kind of turning on one of their own. My point is that I feel like they just were looking for an excuse to kick the ever-living shit out of him because they didn't like what he had become. It's like, no.
So sad.
It is. Oh, it's heartbreaking. Because we want you to be this thing over here that you used to be.
And that we missed that guy.
And we missed that guy.
Yeah.
And you betrayed us by becoming this person.
It could even be more of like, you know, you hear these awful fucking stories of dudes that find out that a good friend they grew up with is gay. And they're like, does that mean I'm fucking gay? Right? Like, they look at Richie and like, that happened to you. Could that happen to me? I'm going to beat it out of you because I'm afraid.
And the mentality of that time, yeah.
You know, yeah, 100%. Yeah. And so, and they needed Leguizamo to co-sign their kind of shit, right?
They needed his seal of approval, yeah. Absolutely. I really feel bad because they knew he was closest to Richie. Then at that point, all stops were pulled. You know what I mean? They had all the excuses they need. All the boxes were checked to go accomplish what they wanted to accomplish.
And do you think, and this is where the performances were, I really enjoyed. I think, I believe them when they said, we're just going to take him to the police station. I don't think that they were going there to beat him down. I think that they believed that. I knew that it was going to happen because Richie wasn't going to go quietly.
That's an interesting question, yeah.
Because Richie wasn't going to go quietly. I think they had themselves convinced, if he just doesn't give us a hard time, all we're going to do is take him to the cops. That's it.
Interesting.
That's all we're going to do. And then here's Richie swinging his guitar and fighting because he doesn't trust him.
Of course.
You know.
That's an interesting thought.
So, and then the look on Rispoli's face when he hears they caught the guy.
Yeah.
It's all over the news. Yeah. And he's like,
no, I know. And that's, it makes you wonder if he would have had the same reaction had he not found out that news.
Mm.
Like I said, I'm wondering whether or not, like what you just said, actually, they went there with maybe good intentions of taking him to the cops. But you rewind 5 minutes earlier where Leguizamo tries to call the cops.
Yeah.
And Rispoli was like, fuck the cops. We're not calling the cops.
Oh,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think he went there with, like you said, maybe the right intentions.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I really believe they went there with the intention to harm. If nothing else, more because they felt betrayed.
Yeah.
I think They were looking for any excuse to try and get their friend back to being the way they wanted him to be.
Yeah. Wow.
And then the reality is that now we've done what we did. He is still who he is. And what have we done?
Right. So that's how that storyline ends up. Leguizamo and Mira Sorvino end up broken up. Great scene when she finally leaves him.
Heartbreaking.
Great scene.
I buy that scene top 100%, to bottom.
100%.
I would honestly say
he does everything. He's throwing shit out the window and she's like, do what you're fucking doing. It's done.
Absolutely. So, yeah. The way she holds his face and says, I just don't believe you anymore.
Oh,
it's so beautifully done. Because there's, he grabs her legs. He's begging. He's on his knees. She can't help but put her hands in his hair. Like she's still fighting.
Yeah.
Her mind is made up, but the love is not gone. The trust is gone.
The marriage is over. Yeah.
The love is still there.
Yeah.
So that is a really devastating scene. Mm. I would also say that any scene with just Leguizamo and Brody, I buy.
Agreed.
My favorite scenes, like whether it be in the diner, when they're talking out on the corner and he gets them all riled up, I don't care. Any of the scenes that were just the two of them, I was really invested in. And I love their chemistry.
And Mira Sorvino, just to get back to her for a second, she was so good in it
that we could do a pod just on her.
That it's every now and then I'm watching the movie, I'm like, oh my gosh, she's gorgeous.
Stunning.
She's
so stunning.
Gorgeous.
And yet she can look just kind of cute.
Yeah,
and play it down.
Plain Jane, if you want. And look at who she worked with in the 90s. Spike Lee, Woody Allen, Robert Redford in Quiz Show.
Yep.
She was amazing in Quiz. Yep. She's worked with some of these luminary fucking directors. Mm-hmm. Okay. From, she's Paul Sorvino's daughter, the late great Paul Sorvino's daughter. And she, I guess retired to raise a family.
There was part of that. I also caught wind that Harvey Weinstein had blacklisted her. Yeah. And so,
wow.
Because I can't remember off the top of my head if he had any involvement with Mighty Aphrodite, but I had read that was someone that he had blacklisted and spread rumors about that she was a problem on set, couldn't show up on time, unprofessional, this or that, and tanked her career.
Brutal. Yeah. Well, let's talk real quick about Spike Lee and how he directed this. Because, not for nothing, but if you just look at, there's 7 or 8 times in the movie where I could cut out a 3 or 4 second scene and show it to a film student and they would think it was a Scorsese movie.
I'm so glad you mentioned that.
With lighting, especially with camera movement and with lighting. Yeah. Bright spotlights, completely washed out in some time. And he never did that before. Spike Lee was known for characters like talking to the camera and do the right thing or with epic 300-page scripts like Malcolm X, right? Yeah. He wasn't really ever that kind of, I want to say proficient, because he knows exactly where to put the camera and all that, but Scorsese kind of takes it to a different level with framing and with lighting, with all of that, and it looks like he was really, this was almost like a concept movie.
Well, the opening sequence, and I know we talked about this in the episode for The Devil Within, was you just watch the way he pans left to right across Berkowitz's apartment. That's very Taxi Driver.
Going over
the desk of was it Danny Aiello, right?
Yep.
Was it hires Bickle? Same kind of thing. We're like, I'm setting the scene. I'm giving you context of what this life is for this person.
Yep.
Something that I don't really see a lot in Spike Lee films, but you could have said, "Score says he shot this." I would have believed you.
I would have. Same.
The graininess of the film.
Yes.
Love that, because he could have shot it. He could have shot that digitally. Chose obviously for the right reasons.
Yep.
Many right reasons not to, but that had a Goodfellas Taxi Driver feel to it, 100%.
Yeah, and he wasn't afraid to show. I mean, Scorsese obviously loves New York. But he shows us a terrible New York.
Right.
An honest, terrible version of New York. It's not like some Nora Ephron, New York's beautiful and everyone falls in love New York.
Correct.
Which is also necessary and fun in movies, right?
Yeah.
Spike Lee also shows, I mean, look, do the right thing, right? Yeah. He showed like basically a race war in Brooklyn.
Very painful.
Right? Yeah. Super painful. Mm-hmm. But showing it this way, just with, again, with camera movement and with really extreme lighting choices that worked so well for the movie, but seemed to be a page right out of Scorsese's playbook.
Yeah, and I get the impression you're not attacking Spike for that. I'm not.
No,
either,
I love it.
You're going to rip off from the best, right?
No, I would love to think that he got there organically.
I would love to think that you can't help but shoot New York at that time any other way.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I actually found myself, I watched the film twice before we had our conversation mm-hmm. today, and I found myself really studying the beach scene. So it's Adrian and John on a beach after Adrian's just smacked himself in the head with the glass.
Yep.
And it's one of the few scenes camera-wise where Spike chose to elevate the camera higher than the actor and shoot down on them, which I always find is an interesting choice.
Yeah.
Because he put the, you know, they walk down a set of steps to get down to the beach from some sort of patio area. Mm-hmm. And Spike left the camera up top as opposed to bringing it down on the beach. Hmm. And I always wonder about those choices from a storytelling standpoint. Why am I looking down at these people at this point? Why are we not shooting them up? Why are we not elevating them? Why are we not face to face? Why are they not in the same, you know, why are they not in the same frame? I always like moments like that, but I there's just certain moments where you can see Spike Lee's signature, but I really do feel like it had such a Scorsese feel to it. And I really found myself wondering how much of that was just the time and the era that maybe this just lends itself to that kind of filmmaking.
Yeah.
That I don't know. But I would love to meet Spike and Martin both one day and ask them that question. Because they're both of them are synonymous, I think, with New York. Obviously, they're both born and bred there. And I really feel like they have such a love for it. You could argue Woody Allen has a very same... a different scope that he sees it through, but a very, very devoted love to New York and insists on shooting there. I also feel, just in talking about Spike, I did not realize he has over, I think, 150 credits.
Oh, yeah.
To his name as a director. Ton of music videos.
Ton of music videos.
Commercials we know he's done in the past as well. I challenge you to find another director that just loves what he does more than Spike, because you wouldn't do it that much if you didn't have an absolute pure joy of it. Talk about somebody who's not worried about being overexposed or oversaturated.
No,
he does not care. He loves to work. He wants to work.
Yep.
And he's damn good at it. But
I met him once.
I love that. Oh, I want to hear about that. But I really am fascinated that somebody like that, who has such a clear narrative in his filmmaking. Like you said, 25th Hour would be another one where it's just a complete departure.
Yep.
I wouldn't have seen that and bought that. Or, you know, maybe even same. Inside Man.
Inside Man?
I'm like, what is that? That is complete. Kinda, you don't do Malcolm X and then do Inside Man. The same person doesn't shoot that those two films.
And then Black Klansman.
Oh, gosh.
Years later, sat to Defy Bloods.
Phenomenal.
Really?
The guy is, I don't think he's spoken about enough as a versatile director. Yeah. But he really can do a lot of different genres and do them beautifully well. Yeah. What you'd hope they'd be.
Yeah. All right. So to wrap this up, scale of 1 to 10, where do you put Summer Sam?
You're talking about just in general, not in terms of Spike Lee's canon. Okay.
Just in general. Below five, you don't recommend. Above five, you do.
Oh yeah, no. It's between a 7 and an 8.
Okay, I would agree.
Yeah, I
would agree.
I really feel like it's. One thing I probably could have used a little bit more of, I would have liked a little bit more music of the time.
That's interesting.
A little bit more. Not much. Yep. I don't need... And I love the lack of score. I liked that. I just would have liked a little bit more... I would say, because, again, I saw it in 99 and then rewatching it, I kind of forget at times it's in the 70s. It's not so you see some of the clothes and the cars and you're kind of like...
Yeah, see, you know
use it a little bit.
That didn't get in my mind because I'm so in that era still from all the work
and
on
you
the
live
podcast.
There. Yeah. And you live there. And I did not live during that time. And I also did not live in that area. I grew up in California. So it just has a different look to me.
Yeah.
And so that would have been nice. But other than that, I mean, I don't think you're going to find, you know, better performances than that. I think the performances were fantastic.
Yep.
It was a good script. I like the angle of not making Berkowitz the main character, but more of a catalyst. And I, again, having not lived through this, I feel like it was a really good way of sharing what happened during that time, yep, or what neighborhoods might have been like at that time and what the people were like. Yeah. So yeah, between a 7 and an 8 for sure.
Cool. I would recommend it also. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Rapid fire questions to end. Okay.
Go for it.
Don't think about it.
Just all right. Answer. Yeah, all right. Hit me.
Art museum or history museum?
Art museum.
Passenger in a car or driver in a car?
Driver.
Beer or wine?
Beer.
Summer or winter?
Winter.
DC or Marvel?
Marvel.
Tattoos or piercings?
Piercings.
Godfather or Goodfellas?
Godfather.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
Food truck or restaurant?
We're on restaurant.
Chocolate or vanilla?
Chocolate or vanilla? Chocolate, yeah.
Rock, paper, scissor, where do you throw first?
Paper, usually.
That's a good one. Where do you land on the Kennedy assassination?
TBD, honestly. Yeah, no, I've been there. I've been to that spot.
So have I.
I've stood on the X's.
Same, next to the X's. Same, in the middle of the street. Yeah.
I mean, if... Okay. Greatest shot of all time, if that was. I mean, I don't mean that, you know.
How about Roswell?
I'm not glorifying it, but I buy Roswell.
Okay.
I buy Roswell.
Are we alone in the universe?
No.
Picasso or Van Gogh?
Picasso.
Mm. Warhol or Basquiat?
Oh, I like Warhol.
Okay. Tupac or Biggie?
Tupac.
Tiger or Phil?
Tiger.
All right, last one. Best pizza in L.A.?
Best pizza in LA. Oh God, that you're talking to a Californian. I'm the last person. All right, who should rate
so maybe
pizza.
You should know.
Oh, I shouldn't rate pizza at all. I went to New York and I was like, oh geez, give me more of this. Like
That's the best answer. Okay,
I'm gonna say that.
Best pizza in LA is in New York.
Yeah, okay. Best pizza in LA is out of LAX. Take a first flight down to Manhattan and get yourself a slice. Otherwise, you know, you can give me Papa John's and I'm probably gonna be okay with that.
All right. Well, Jeff Marshall, thank you again for showing up with us. Tell people where they can find you and hear more of you.
The podcast is On the Craft. It's heavily based around film, but covers all various art forms, at least the 7 by definition and the ones that aren't. We talk to chefs. We talk to landscape designers. We talk to teachers. So whatever your craft might be. But yeah, thanks for having me on the show, man.
Excellent. For anybody out there, go look up Jeff Marshall on the craft. Hope you enjoyed this bonus episode of A Season in Hell. We'll catch up with you next time. You can find us on all of your socials at The Devil Within Pod. And you can listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time. Stay safe out there. The Devil Within, A Season in Hell, is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.